This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for lectures, features, and radio shows. And now, here's Coy Barefoot.
Dr. Arthur Tim Garson, Jr. is an internationally recognized pediatric cardiologist who now serves as Executive Vice President and Provost of the University of Virginia. From 2002 to 2007, he served as Dean of the UVA School of Medicine. He is the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths and Not Enough Reality. He joins me live in studio. It's good to see you again.
Good afternoon, Coy. Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. I appreciate it. I know you're one of the busiest men in Virginia, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We want to talk about the healthcare issue. Every time we see these candidates make a speech, they always take a moment to include healthcare in what they say. Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter. It clearly is one of the driving issues of the race for the president here in 2008. But before we get there, just by way of review, I wanted to, if we can, just spend a moment talking about your book and also a recent op-ed that you had just yesterday in USA Today titled "Prevention is Good Medicine, but It's Not a Fiscal Panacea." I remember from our last conversation that is one of the half-truths, one of the myths that you are trying to tackle here in your efforts to educate Americans, and really with this vision to see Americans more up on understanding healthcare in America. It's so that we don't just listen to these politicians keep spewing half-truths to us, so that we can be more educated when we go to the polling place.
Coy, you'll be pleased to know, and I know you've read the book, that the words fiscal panacea clearly came from USA Today and did not come from me. No way in the world would I have written fiscal panacea.
You don't do titles, right?
I don't do words with that many syllables.
Remind folks again, let me tell you this. Could you remind folks again of the distinction when we talk about healthcare and we talk about medical care, that's probably the best place to begin our understanding of healthcare in America, is to understand there's a difference between healthcare and medical care.
Well, it is. Let me put it into a little bit of context, because the real reason we started the book with that, and the book is 20 Myths, and this refers to chapter one, that says American medical care is second rate compared to other developed countries, and that's false. Now, the reason we started there is the headlines over and over again that we spend all this money and we get nothing for it. And what this addresses is the fact that we spend a lot of money, but we actually get a fair amount for it. You don't see people getting on the airplane and going to London to get their operations. Now, that we could talk about later as a sort of another interesting issue around medical tourism, of people are going away, but it's not to get better medical care, it's to get cheaper medical care. So we would come back to the question of why do we care about the difference between medical care and health care, and let me tell you as part of that issue. So health care has to do with the two big statistics of life expectancy and infant mortality. So the two, when you say to some country, how's your health care? What you look at is life expectancy. And in fact, the life expectancy in Harlem, in New York City, is lower than the life expectancy in Bangladesh. Now, you'd say, I get it. Life expectancy is not all about heart surgery. The infant mortality in Southeast Washington, D.C., is the same as in some parts of Africa. That's not doctor care. So the issue with both of those are stark examples of saying that, in fact, the statistics are about a whole lot of things. Life expectancy is about a lot of things, only a small percentage of which is what doctors do, and that's medical care. So healthcare, the big thing, 40% due to lifestyle, 30% due to genetics, 20% due to public health, 10% due to medical care. And so
just 10%
you got it,
of what you go to the hospital for is about health care.
10% of life expectancy.
Of life expectancy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, what has happened, and another way of sort of making it stark, is the World Health Organization has 10 different categories of life expectancy, if you die from A or B or C. Well, they just added an 11th category, which is death due to terrorism. So clearly, there are a number of ways that one can get a shortened life expectancy, whether it's from smoking, whether it's from drinking, whether it's from an automobile accident or murder, that has very little, if anything, to do with medical care, which is a smaller amount and actually pretty good in the United States. Not perfect, but pretty good. That's the difference.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Garson, provost of the University of Virginia and the former dean of the UVA School of Medicine. He's the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths and Not Enough Reality. You must get incredibly frustrated when you see these speeches the politicians give. And I can't imagine being you and just watching some of these speeches, knowing what you know and realizing you just want to throw your shoe at the television and say, why can't you just be honest with people? Or why don't you finish that statement and tell them what's really going on?
Part of me wants to say these people have a rough year. So to say, I would imagine there are people in foreign affairs, in almost any discipline, that would wind up saying the same thing. I wish you would say more.
Right. Right.
Let me give you an example. The notion of how to pay for whatever of the plans that is enacted, whether it is Republican or Democrat, if you go to any website, they're not there. There are outlines of, yes, we will improve efficiency. What does that mean? And yes, we will have improved information technology. Well, the fact of the matter, I believe, is information technology will save money. I really do. And it's the right thing to say. But if you then say, okay, exactly how much, and if you're really planning on covering the uninsured with that money, show me the time period over which that will occur, even within a couple of years, and it's not there. So the frustrating thing for me is that it's, first of all, very difficult to do that. That is not an easy event to sort of say, and I'm not sure I know a lot of people that could do that with the kind of accuracy that you really need to say, no, I'm sorry, we need $100 billion in year 5
right.
to cover the uninsured. Now, that's a real number. Now, where does that come from in 2013? And that's difficult. But that's, to me, one of the, as you start to look at the different candidates' proposals, there's sort of 5 things that I think about, and that's one of them, which is, well, where's the money? And for those that say where the money is, you'd like to see a little more specificity. And that's tough. That's asking for a lot. But the notion that if someone gets elected and there are a number of things that say we're going to do these things and we're going to rely on information technology efficiency to make it happen, that's exactly how that works is unfortunately not there.
My guest is Dr. Tim Garson, provost of the University of Virginia and former dean of the UVA School of Medicine. He is the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. If you have a comment or a question regarding healthcare and the race for the presidency, what would you like to see happen, and how would you do it? You mentioned these some principles. Can you help us understand how we as voters, perhaps when we hear these candidates talking about healthcare, perhaps some of the things, if there are any type of metrics or principles that we can use to gauge what they're saying and understand what they're saying.
You bet. Let's go through them. And in fact, in terms of, I think, issue of priority, the voter is going to have to decide whether she or he really thinks it's important to provide health care coverage for everybody. That's a decision that each voter is going to have to make, right? Some of the proposals are for coverage for everyone. The words universal coverage, I think, get confused with socialized medicine, get confused with Canada. So if you just say coverage for everybody, we know what that means. That means somebody's got some form of either public or private health insurance. That's what that means. But there are people who say, no, that's actually not very important to me. So that axis, that decision of is it or is it not important, should help in deciding at the very, very top level which candidate you think you want to go with, really on that basis. So that's one. Second is, if there is to be some kind of healthcare system, is it all public, like Medicare and Medicaid? Is it all private, like individual health insurance companies? Or is it a mix? And then when you'd say, well, how do I decide that? Well, I think, again, it's pretty much of a gut reaction on the part of the person that says, well, I'm more of a public-oriented, I want more Medicare and Medicaid for people, or I am more of a person that is more interested in private insurance for people, or both. So first, do you want coverage for everybody? Second, what would the system look like? Third is a whole question around personal responsibility. Do you believe that people should or should not take care of themselves? Now, that's a little bit hard for somebody to say, no, I think it's just fine to have an entire country of people that weigh 5,000 pounds. So that one is a little easier to sort of say, well, does the candidate recognize that individual responsibility is important and that people, to a certain extent, need to take care of themselves?
Right, right.
And
especially if you have a public system and we're all chipping in. If you have any type of public system, you want to look at your neighbor and say, hey, take care of yourself because I'm helping to pay for your medical care.
Yeah, but even if you have a private system, if your neighbor's unhealthy, your rates are going to go up.
Right.
So
right.
It just makes sense for yourself and it makes sense for others. The fourth is that we all ought to be committed to a higher quality healthcare system. Now, that's a word that, in fact, has some words that go with it. Quality's been defined by some smart people in Washington. Some of the dimensions are something called safety, meaning no medical errors. Well, that's a pretty good thing to have. That's a good thing to strive for, is a safe medical care system. There are medication errors that we know about. There are other kind of errors that occur. You would like to strive for a system that doesn't have those kinds of errors. Okay? An effective system, one that does the best medicine at the right time, that's understood, and that if there are national guidelines, that they're followed. There are right now, in one study, up to a 10 times variation in the cost of certain procedures in different parts of the United States.
10 times different?
10 times.
So you could go somewhere else and pay 10 times less.
You bet. And in fact, the study, it's not quite 10 times. The study that is often quoted is, in the last several months of life, how much was spent in different parts of the country in different medical centers. And there is an immense difference. The outcome, by definition, is the same. You've died. and it's how much was spent in those last months, and that varies all over the place.
Just as markets vary, I guess. Is that it? Like, we pay a lot more for gasoline in Charlottesville than they do in Stanton.
You know? We do, but there's also difference in doctor practice. And I think there need to be better and better guidelines to help doctors to decide what to do and what not to do. Those are getting better and better. They're still not perfect, but they're getting better and better. So it's those kinds of things we ought to, and a candidate should say, that quality stuff is important to me.
Yeah.
Similarly, so's cost. Okay? It's got to be, clearly, we can't go on spending the money we spend. We spend $7,000 per person in the United States for our medical care. That's twice the next one down. So it's we spend a lot. We do pretty well with outcomes, but we don't do all that well. The interesting thing is those two actually match when you'd say, well, is our healthcare outcome of life expectancy related to something else other than medical care? And the answer is the uninsured. So the other countries that look like they do better on heart attack mortality, if you take out our uninsured, we don't look so bad. So one of the worst things that leads to our bad life expectancy is, in fact, people who don't have health insurance. People who don't have health insurance die a lot faster from heart disease, from cancer, from diabetes.
They tend not to have, I was going to say quality, but any preventative medicine. They're often relying on emergency rooms, which, as you pointed out in a previous discussion we've had, is just relying on emergency medicine. They don't get regular follow-ups. They don't get preventative medicine. They don't get regular consultations. You're just, it's literally by definition, emergency medicine.
Correct.
And as a result, those people will not live long and healthy lives.
That's exactly right. And so we now have the five principles of the, and each person, each voter, should be able to look and say, okay, what do I think about whether everybody ought to have health care coverage? There's clear difference across the candidates. Secondly, what do I think about public and private? There's a difference. Thirdly, personal responsibility. Most of them talk about that, but some may ring somebody's bell or some not. Four, cost and quality. And five, a little bit tougher for everybody to sort of get into, but have they really told you how they're going to pay for it? Have they really, if you look at it and you say, okay, that's my budget, I know how I'm going to get groceries next week, and I put that hat on. If you look at that and you say, and anybody really telling there, and the numbers are there, but they're and again, it's tough. It may not be as simple as anyone thinks, but
right,
the numbers
right.
aren't quite there.
And it may be asking too much of a campaign platform to get into that kind of detail. And certainly most voters aren't looking for that. But when it comes to making, if you're making your decision when you go to the voting booth, if one of the priority concerns for you is health care, and that is for millions of Americans, when they go to vote in the primary or when they go to vote in November, many Americans are thinking, hey, the most important thing for me and my family, for whatever reason, is health care. We're really concerned about that, and this is a way to really help us make a decision come November. We're going to continue this discussion in the next half hour after a break here at the bottom for local news and weather. We are talking with Dr. Tim Garson, provost of the University of Virginia and the former dean of the UVA School of Medicine. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
You're listening to the podcast of Charlottesville Right Now with Poi Barefoot. Podcasting of the show is made available by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network.
Dr. Tim Garson is an internationally recognized pediatric cardiologist. He serves as executive vice president and provost at the University of Virginia. He is the recent past dean of the UVA School of Medicine and the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths and Not Enough Realities. We're honored to have him here live in studio, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070 if you've got a comment or a question about health care and public policy and the race for the president here this year. When we last spoke, you had said, I'm reasonably optimistic when you look at the candidates, and this was last summer, you said, I'm reasonably optimistic that something effective and positive can really be done about healthcare in America. given now a few months later, we're down to arguably three candidates here, one on the Republican side, still two vying for the Democratic nomination. Are you still reasonably optimistic?
I guess if I would have thought that reasonably optimistic was a six, I might be at a five.
Okay.
I'm an optimistic person, and I really think that there has been too much said about health care in this election to ignore it. Having said that, we all know that there are some very serious issues facing the country. Health care shows up third, but not 12th. So I think that we will see movement in health care regardless of who the eventual president is. But when we left off last half hour, I think some of the issue is really going to be, can we afford it and where's the money going to come from?
Because clearly, we don't have a great economy right now. It's hurting. The experts say that it's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better. We are spending hundreds of billions of dollars in Iraq. And in our last conversation, we were talking about the fact that unless priorities shift, and some of the money comes out of what we spend in the war on terror and goes to health care, for example, or some other issues, it's going to be difficult to say where this money might come from to seriously address health care in America.
Yeah, that's right. I suspect that some of this is a given and should be. I think the war on terror has got to be there. There are some discretionary issues that clearly any new president is going to face. There are taxing issues that any new president is going to face, and we'll just have to see. But I think that's my biggest concern. It's not that people won't think about it. It's where's the money?
Are you seeing, we've spoken in the past about this whole idea of federalism and a federalist approach to health care, in seeing different states experiment with different approaches and sort of getting to a point where we can do a best practices study and say, boy, California did this and that works great, or Massachusetts tried that. Can you update us about what's happening in the states, and is there any particular state that's doing something really well?
I can. I think at last look, there were more than half of the states. There were about 27 or 28 states that were doing something. And when you say something, that varies all the way from changing Medicaid of how the public system works to expanding private insurance for how a private system might work. In fact, there is a bill in the General Assembly in Virginia to expand the private system here in Virginia for small businesses. So they're all done somewhat differently. The two that most definitely got the biggest press and the most attention were Massachusetts and California. Massachusetts became law. California did not. Massachusetts, therefore, has, in fact, an individual mandate, which means everybody has to have health insurance. Now, that's a very different place than I would have thought 5 years ago we would have been, but it's fascinating to me that Massachusetts did it. Now, what Massachusetts has done is, in fact, said everyone who can afford it, which is very sensible. But what they're having obvious trouble with is their definition of afford. So if you just sort of run the numbers, and I'll try to do it in a way that is not higher math, because I don't do higher math. If you say that in general, people may be willing to spend up to 5% of their income on health care. That's a number that is used pretty consistently, not just in the United States, but around the world. So 5% of income on health care. For the very, very poor, obviously close to zero, and the ones bordering on very poor, maybe 3% of income. But for most people who make, for example, an individual making $20,000 a year, if you ask, is perhaps willing to spend $1,000 on healthcare per year. Okay, so 5% of a $20,000. Right. Well, an individual premium in today's world is anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 in the individual market. And so somebody who is out fending for herself or himself, who works in largely a small business, who doesn't provide health insurance, what they are faced with is a premium of $3,000 to $5,000 when what they normally could afford is $1,000. Now, that's the major issue of why we have so many uninsured. 4 out of 5 people who are uninsured are in families that work. This is not the people who don't work and who are just sitting by the side of the road. The reason we have so many uninsured is it's expensive, right? Everybody says, oh, well, there's this segment of people who make more than $75,000 a year who don't have health insurance. Yes, there are. It's about 20% of people. The other 80% really cannot afford it. That's how come we have so many uninsured. And then you'd say, no. What about Medicaid? Medicaid covers those people. No, it doesn't. Medicaid covers you if you're under 18 or over 65, and that's it. In the middle, between 19 and 64, you have to be disabled totally, have kidney disease, or be blind, or you've had it. If you're an adult.
I think that's a common misconception a lot of people have, because they think the working poor, well, they got Medicaid. There's a safety net for them. Well, it's not. They're going to the emergency room.
You got it. Otherwise, how could you come up with a number like 47 million uninsured, right? That's more than the whole population of Canada, more than the whole population of Australia, including kangaroos. I mean, that's a large number of people. So 47 million people, there are 23 states that don't add to 47 million people. If you add up the smallest states, a huge number of people.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Garson of the University of Virginia, provost and past dean of the UVA School of Medicine. That is absolutely amazing. Can you talk a little bit about this idea that this, you know, nearly 50 million people in America who are uninsured, those of us who are insured, we actually pay higher fees, higher premiums, because of the fact that so many people are uninsured. And that, again, is another misconception that most people have. They say, well, that's basically your problem. You don't have health insurance. Go get a better job. Go back to school, get another degree, and make more money, and you'll be okay. That's your problem. Well, fella, that's your problem, too. You pay a higher premium because your neighbor doesn't have health insurance.
There's an elegant study that's done that looks at exactly that. And to get quickly to the point, an individual premium is $450 more expensive because of the uninsured, and a family premium is $900 more expensive because of the uninsured. Recognize that that's just paying for the uninsured who show up in the emergency room or who become hospitalized. Obviously, the 47 million people, as we talked about before, do not have adequate medical care. They get about half. When you look in prescription drugs, and what happens is it comes out of the uninsured's pocket to the extent they can. But they get about half the medical care of the people who are insured, and they die more than twice as quickly.
I've read about some studies that say in European countries where the government is more involved in paying for health care, that health care costs less because you have the government working with providers to get less costs. And it's something that insurance companies and providers have sort of tied the hands of government in Washington and said, no, we don't want you negotiating for less costs. We don't want people to be able to go to Canada and get less drugs. And yet it seems that in some other countries, like in Europe, for example, when the government is involved, costs go down. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, I mean, the problem or the opportunity in looking internationally is that it is not simply one thing. That you'd say, well, the government gets to negotiate prices, therefore the prices are lower. Correct. But also there are issues in many foreign countries with waiting lists because of the amount of money not put into the system. So it's not one single... You're absolutely right. The issue of what that looks like across different... countries can in any one isolated way look great or look terrible. And you've got, I think, to come back and the title of chapter 19, where chapter 19 begins with the reason we don't have a Canadian healthcare system in the United States is we're not Canadian. And so there are things that Canadians like to put up with that the United States won't. So we have to be very careful in going from one to the other and saying, well, why don't we do that?
Yeah, yeah. That's a great point. Dr. Tim Garson is provost at the University of Virginia, past dean of the UVA School of Medicine. He's the co-author of the book Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths and Not Enough Reality. We hear some candidates talking about, well, I'm going to pay for my healthcare bill with preventative medicine. If we just had people taking better care of themselves, we wouldn't have to spend so much money fixing them when things go wrong, when they get sick. Is that accurate to say? This was your op-ed in yesterday's USA Today. You addressed this very topic.
That's right. I think that it's complicated. The overall summary can be looked at from a study that came out last week from Holland. And you might say, well, we're not Holland. Well, we may be worse than Holland in this respect. So what the study from Holland showed was that people who smoke died at an average age of 77, and their lifetime healthcare costs were $100,000 less than the thin non-smokers who died at 84. The obese people died at the age of 80 and saved about $50,000 in lifetime medical care costs compared to those that died at 84. Now, that's a look that the United States doesn't get to take very easily because the Dutch system is one whole system. So they get to look at lifetime costs. When we look at small pieces, we do a great job of saving money with prevention. So when you say, well, does measles vaccination save money? Sure it does. Are there wellness programs that companies put on? Sure there are. Do they save money in the middle of life? Sure they do. We end our chapter on this with a salute to Bill Crutchfield, who has a whole system of rewarding people for taking care of themselves. So that's all the right thing to do. And I think what we've got to be very careful to say over and over again is prevention is the right thing to do. It saves lives. It makes you live longer. It's good for you. But if you are a presidential candidate looking for money at the end of the day, that money's not likely to be there. Now,
just from prevention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I quote my father, which makes a whole lot more sense than some of the other stories I've told. And he said, he's sort of an expert on aging, and he said in his sort of 70s, he said that the goal of aging ought to be to have the longest possible early old age and to have late old age last 15 minutes. Right. Now, if we can pull that off, preventive care will save money. But remember how much money we spend in the last 6 months of life.
It's incredibly expensive, yeah.
Remember how much money that, and unfortunately, the way currently life goes, the way medical care costs increase right now, they increase at about double the rate of other costs and wages. And so it is increasingly more expensive to die from the same disease the longer you are from today. So it is unfortunate but true. Prevention is very important. Prevention has to be done. It just doesn't. There isn't enough savings in an entire healthcare system to pay for the uninsured.
To free up enough money to cover nearly 50 million Americans.
That's correct.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Garson. Before I let you go, we've got a couple of minutes left. Just the last question. I would like you to imagine, if you can, that you're, let's say you're the Surgeon General of the United States, which for me personally, I don't think that's a big stretch to imagine here, but let's say you have the ear of this new president come January of 09, and he or she calls you into the White House and says, Tim, what do we do first? Where should I go? What's the first step here? Where should this country go? Where's our first step towards an improved, a better, or solving this crisis that we are in as a nation as far as healthcare is concerned?
Great question. I believe, and the good news is you'd get 43 different answers. I believe job one is to improve the quality of the healthcare system and reduce cost in the following a few ways. I would figure out a way to help every single doctor and every single patient to have an electronic medical record. Okay, that sounds easy or hard. But until we are able to do that one simple thing, we won't even have a handle on our quality of care. Imagine that you can now walk into a doctor's office. The doctor hasn't spent 17 years trying to go through your 17 charts. She knows exactly what tests you had at the other place yesterday. And she says, admit Coy to the hospital, and the screen turns red, and it says Coy doesn't need to be admitted to the hospital. And the reason that it turns red and says Coy doesn't need to be admitted to the hospital is that the computer just looked at 176,000 cases that were just like Coy in real time. Now, that's not that far off, okay? The idea of pooling those kinds of data from that many patients is you won't be able to get there until everybody has an electronic medical record. Now, that sounds like a sort of a goofy place to start, but if everybody had that kind of record, I believe doctors would find it a lot easier to have almost automated reminders of how to help take care of patients. That variation of 10 times in cost would disappear.
Yeah.
So there are all those kinds of cost and quality things that we could do pretty quickly.
And this is short term. We would see results from that in the short term.
Well, we would. The problem is that everybody's got to have one. And they're expensive. And so whether that becomes a government subsidy, you know, carrot stick,
right.
After some period of time, everybody has to have one, that's a sort of an interesting thing of how you'd like to approach it. In the meantime, while that's going on, I would look very carefully to some of the states. I'd look very carefully to what's going on in Massachusetts. I'd learn from Massachusetts. I'd learn from why California didn't pass. I would learn from some of the other state experiments. And in fact, there is a bill before the U.S. Congress to help the states with federal money to do experimentation or better innovation in their own state programs. So we might want to, while we're getting some of these other things together, trying to find the money, I think maybe the first thing that I would do, watch the states, help the states in their experiments, and try to get cost and quality under control.
Dr. Tim Garson is the provost of the University of Virginia and past dean of the UVA School of Medicine. He's the co-author of Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths and Not Enough Reality. It's always an honor to have you in here. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Coy. It was a real pleasure.
You've been listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. The show is on the air Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. Join in on the show by calling 434-977-1070 or feel free to leave a comment on the show at SevillePodcast.com. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network.